is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Do you want your athletes to be more fit, healthy, and well, or not? Okay. Are these social media platforms making them more fit, healthy, or well, or are they not?
Phil White is an Emmy-nominated writer and the co-author of The Leader's Mind. Phil is also the co-host of the Basketball Strong podcast. His other books include The 17-Hour Fast, Waterman 2.0, Unplugged, and Game Changer. Hey, Hoopheads, start this school year off strong with up to $4,000 off Dr. Dish basketball shooting machines. Huge back-to-school savings with Dr. Dish, up to $4,000 off their professional shooting machine lineup. Dr. Dish Basketball is here to help you make this school year the best yet with exclusive offers on their All-Star Plus, Rebel Plus, and CT Plus shooting machines, all designed to give your team the ultimate training experience. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Nick Legalbo, head boys basketball coach at Lane Tech High School in Chicago, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Phil White, co-author of The Leader's Mind and co-host of the Basketball Strong podcast. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkle tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by author, podcaster, jack of all trades, Phil White. Phil, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Oh, thank you, sir. Appreciate being here.
Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your career and tapping into some of the knowledge that you've shared both in your books and your podcast and everything that's going on there. So I want to give you a chance to share those things. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing and how you got involved in athletics.
Yeah, so growing up in Southwest England, not far from the town of Cheddar, which is where cheddar cheese comes from. So it's cheddar country, dairy farming, a lot of tourism. So kind of close to Bath and Stonehenge, that field full of big rocks down that part of the world. So yeah, so that was good. And just grew up playing outside with my brother Barry, and he was the much better natural athlete. Actually ended up playing with Southampton FC's academy for a couple of years, so obviously a Premier League team until recently when we got relegated, unfortunately. But Premier League tragedies aside, yeah, he was a great sprinter, naturally way stronger. But so it's weird because most people are looking up to an older brother athletically, and I was looking up to a younger one. But anyway, so I kind of found my jam with basketball. A friend, Steve Mather, introduced me to that, and a good friend of his was coaching his two sons, and he was involved in kind of the county setup, which is our equivalent of state. And so eventually I worked my way up from being able to not make a layup at probably age 14, 15, to starting for county. And then I also at a Nike camp ran into a guy named Anthony Barnett, and he played for the Bristol Buccaneers in the National League in England. And so anyone listening that may have come up at that time will know his name is the big 6'7" beast. And if you didn't move your feet, he was going to dunk all over you all day. And so people may not think of of basketball in England this way, but I was one of only two white guys on this team. This was inner city Bristol. It was dangerous enough that he would have to come meet me at Bristol Temple Meads train station and walk me to and from practice and games. So I was sacrificing from an early age to try to learn the game. And to get there, you can get there by train, but you had to take a bunch of trains, and then it was probably a 30-minute walk. So that was to and from practice. I'd get back at midnight or 1 in the morning. My dad would pick me up from the train station. We'd drive 5 miles back home. And then there was usually a game away at the weekend, like Peterborough, or pick anywhere, pick any mid-sized city in England. And we played them. And because of Anthony and a couple other guys, we often beat them. And there's an old joke in England when they say, what position did you play? And you say left back. And they say, oh, yeah. And left back in the changing rooms. So it wasn't quite that, but I was on the bench. But again, in practice, there was a guy, Aaron, that the Mac McClung dunk, where he could touch it off the top of the shooting square, pull it back, and then reverse it. He could do that at 6'3". And if you didn't move your feet, you were going to get crammed on. And so I learned how to defend and eventually applied for this service called College Prospects of America. And I think it's still going, and they represent you and send out you both your academic and your sports profile. And a lot of times they were mailing this thing out, you know, late 90s, there was none of this, none of these recruiting apps, no Huddle, you know? And so, yeah, I almost went to the school where it sounds like one of your kiddos is going at Denison, went to Kenyon College, but D3 doesn't offer athletic scholarships. And so I went back home and went to Plymouth University for the best part of a year. But when I was home for Christmas, I found an old recruiting letter that had somehow missed. And it was from Coach Rocky Lamar, who anyone that's played college basketball in America, any coach knows that name. He recently retired with 803 wins. He's on the list with Coach K, Jim Boeheim, as all-time leader in college basketball, and won a national championship and should have won many, many more. I think 6 straight Final Fours in the NAIA. And just some amazing players there. Aaron Harris, Dan Fleming. So again, I had to play JV basically and hardly even sniff varsity, but played basketball and soccer for him at Mid-American Nazarene in Kansas City. Met my wife, and now we have two beautiful kids. Johnny's 16, Harry's almost 14, and we live in Evergreen, Colorado, which is just up I-70 West from Denver. So there's the life story.
There you go. What was the transition like coming overseas to the U.S., leaving England?
Hard to leave my mom, my brother, my sisters, real close to all my nieces and nephews, and you know, my dad grinds. You know, my dad is where my work ethic comes from. He a small stonemason's business and worked all the hours God gave and drove a taxi at the weekend. Even ended up taking a third job cleaning a car dealership to make some extra money to be able to help me and help my brother. And and then my mom was a freelance journalist. She worked for a mayor of our local town. She worked real estate. And so they were just both grinders. And then my mom was the storyteller, which is where the storytelling piece comes from.
Did your parents watch you play a lot when you were in England? And then when you came over here, did they ever come over to watch you play?
Never. Mm-mm. No. My dad would do the books for his business if he had to drop me off at practice. And then, like I said, I was solo going into Bristol and then National League. And, my mom was dealing with everything on some things on the home front and health-wise. She's had fibromyalgia and arthritis for a long time and dealing with all of that drama. And my dad was just grinding always. He took 1 week off a year. A guy at his church would rent out a beach house to anyone that wanted to pay £50. I think it was maybe £75 near the end. And being an English summer, it could be 75 degrees and beautiful every day, and it could be rained out every day. And that was the only time he took off all year, bro, just grinding since he was 15, 16 years old.
When you came over here and you're playing college basketball, what was your thought process academically? What'd you major in? What'd you think you wanted to do with yourself?
So initially I was an athletic training major. And I really liked that. We had some great PTs, a great strength coaching program there. Now it's Whitney Rodden took over from Coach Cross, who had worked with Tubby Smith, had worked real close with the Olympic Training Center down in Colorado Springs and Olympic lifting. And imagine the gunnery sergeant from Full Metal Jacket. That was Coach Cross, right? Without the swearing, because it's a Christian school. But he would kick guys out of the weight room for bench press. And he'd say, tell me a sport where you have to lie on your back and push weight off of you. So
that's funny.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And he would close our weightlifting sessions when everyone's fatigued. He'd go out and put his big old Ford truck in neutral and have three guys on the back. We'd be divided into teams of three and have us push him across the parking lot with his kind of, he'd be yelling that we were a bunch of weaklings out the car window, like just an absolute trip. But it got me into Olympic lifting, and kind of like with Andy Galpin, who self-taught himself it, there was a little bit of that, but then, you know, coach helped me and then Coach Rodden helped me. And so I never competed in it, but just kind of kept that up pretty good. And so, yeah, just a great, and they were actually, there was only one of two schools to compete every year at collegiate nationals against Division I programs. And we had some athletes like John Booth, played on the Chiefs, he actually caught the last touchdown pass of NFL Europe when his team won. I think he was on the Amsterdam team. And him and his brother James were just athletic freaks. And my buddy Jermaine was from Jamaica. Our 4x1 team and 4x4 team has beaten Division I squads. And so that was kind of fun to watch. Great track team as well. So, yeah, it was a real experience to be around these freaky athletes, which at the NAIA level I never thought, and I never thought the level of coaching would be there either.
What was your favorite memory from playing basketball at college?
I think just practicing with and against a player like Dan Fleming, who he broke Scottie Pippen's NAIA scoring record in the national tournament one year. And just having to go against a guy like that in practice and see some, or another guy, Adam Utes, who is an All-American. He was probably 6'4.5", 6'5", and built like Charles Barkley. Like, people, centers would come in and they'd be 6'9", 6'10". They think, I'm going to dunk all over this guy. But they were not dunking on Adam Utes. He would hit him freaking hard. He was a bull in the post and a grinder. And so just, yeah, a combination of Dan Fleming's just sheer athleticism and scoring talent, and then a bull like Adam Utes and having to try to belly up with a guy that outweighs you by 50, 60 pounds in the post when you're giving up size and height. And that was, yeah, some interesting stuff.
Were you planning to stay in the U.S. when you graduated, or were you planning to go back to England?
I was probably planning to go back, but then one time I was out with a group of friends at Old Chicago, and it was another group of friends there, and there was one of these girls was my future wife's cousin, and I think the only conversation I had with my future wife, Nicole, was I said, hey, can I try that drink? That looks kind of weird. It was like some orangey cocktail thing. And my buddy, Lucky, Tyler Lux, he said, he was like, no, don't be a pussy, man. You know we got to be up at 5 for lifting, dude. Coach Cross is going to be kicking our ass. You can't be doing that. And Lucky was a pole vaulter, actually, but just a freaky athlete. And so him and my training buddies, Corey Maxwell, were kicking my ass. Like, no, bro, you can't touch that. So anyway, we're in the cafeteria the next day after this lifting session for breakfast, and her cousin Emily comes up and is like, hey, remember my cousin Nicole last night? And I was like, yeah, you know, we talked for a couple of minutes. And she was like, well, here's a number. She wants to take you out on a date. And dude, that doesn't happen too often.
That works. That works really well. That's the way you want to have it set up.
And if you saw a picture of my wife, you know, I married up a few divisions, you know, a few leagues. And so, yeah, we were engaged after 4 months, married for another four. And then I did 68 hours of school, bro. I put my junior and senior year together, 34 hours per semester for two semesters.
Wow. Holy cow.
She was working at an accounting firm to support us. And then, yeah, that was that. So somehow got a ring on her finger. I don't know how. July 4th was our 20-year anniversary. So, yeah, I was staying at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations on all of that.
Thanks,
yeah, when the girl comes and talks to you, that's always a positive.
I still don't understand it.
Same idea. My wife, we were out at like a whatever bar, club, and this place was called The Basement. And there was like, it was set up like an old grandparents' basement, you know, like washers and dryers, whatever. And she was dancing on the washer and came down, and she was supposedly looking for a guy with blonde curly hair, and found me with what little hair I had even back then. So it's just that makes it easy on us guys.
Oh, you know, I still don't know what she was thinking. She probably doesn't either. I talked to my good buddy Ben Spicer back in England recently, my rugby playing friend. Him and John O'Lloyd, kind of my training buddies, we go run sprints for an hour at the rugby club and then go lift in this little gym up there at North Dorset Rugby, of all places. And he said, 20 years, bloody hell, mate, she would have got less than that for murder.
Isn't that the truth? We're all lucky and blessed in our own way, right? Mm-hmm. That somehow they stay with us, goofy guys, and
somehow
put up with all our shenanigans. Somehow. So that's the way it goes. All right, so talk to me a little bit about your career after you graduate. You're married. You're trying to figure things out. You're in a new country. Where do you go? What's the idea?
Yeah, so I switched majors to English. I had a great professor called Tyler Blake, and just blessed to learn from him. And then, as luck would have it, my newspaper advisor Kevin Wright was the chief editor of the Olathe Daily News, which is the paper there by Mid-America in suburban Kansas City. And we had been tasked with a professor called Jeannie Milhoff, who was also amazing, had us do a feature story on someone interesting on campus, right? And it couldn't be a student, it had to be some, you know, staff member. And so a good family friend of my wife's, Roland Gilliland, who since unfortunately had Parkinson's in his past, but him and his wife were great family friends of my wife's family. And he was a locksmith, and he got so good at being a locksmith that the FBI and the CIA would have him come in to crack safes. And this guy was a pilot. He was a hunter. He was just a real Renaissance man and a great storyteller, and almost like an honorary grandparent to my kids, really. And so did this story on Roland, and Professor Milhoff liked this story, I guess. And so I was back in England grinding, working double shifts at pubs, which when you go to a Nazarene school where there's no drinking or dancing allowed, at least allegedly, it's kind of ironic when you're working behind a bar and drinking at the rugby club on a Saturday, you know. I don't think my Guinness habit would have gone over too well. But anyway, so irony aside, I got back and my mother-in-law, Janice, said, hey, have you seen the Olathe Daily News yet? And I said, no, what do you mean? And she was like, well, your story's the cover story of the new issue. And I was like, what are you talking about? She said, that piece you did on Roland, I guess your advisors like that. And so that was my first portfolio piece, bro. And then a good buddy of mine, Luke Kreisel, was editor at Nylon Magazine, and they had a thing called Nylon for Guys as well. So really a fashion magazine. But this guy was interviewed. He was out getting drunk with Matthew McConaughey, you know, like doing some really cool shit. And so he started having me do front of book copy, which in magazine speak is tiny pieces, like 200 words on Japanese selvedge denim that this American company is sourcing, or just this random mini film reviews, album reviews, just throwing me some work to build up my portfolio and really mentor me through that. And then he called me one day and he was like, hey, bro, you know that that book I'm writing. So he had teamed up with a guy, Rob Principi, who started this Scratch DJ Academy with a member of with Jam Master Jay from Run DMC. Yep. And really, it's just teaching people how to DJ. And so they started on vinyl, then they got into CDJs, and now like the pioneer stuff you can do with MP3s. And Luke had agreed to do a book on kind of the history and culture of DJing and a bit of a how-to, but his dad was real sick with stomach cancer, and so he was going back and forth between New York and then to London and then an hour and a half, 2 hour drive back down to where we're from. And luckily his dad was in remission and managed to come through. But he was like, dude, I owe these guys 80,000 words in 3.5 months. So I got 800 words. Do you think you could step in and help me finish this thing? And so with a 2-year-old at the time, Johnny's now 16, so it would have been 14 years ago, and a full-time job at a software company, I literally worked every night and every weekend, and I'd be up till 5 a.m. interviewing DJs on, and it was everyone from DJ Jazzy Jeff, who went from the Fresh Prince to being like a really well-regarded house music producer, BT, the Grammy-nominated composer that scored the film Monster, Above and Beyond, the guys from England, Paul Oakenfold, Pete Tong, anyone hip-hop or electronic that you've heard of in the last 30 years, we interviewed, and then we wrote it. And then 3.5 months later, bro, we had like a 90,000-word book done. And so that proved I could do it, and that really gave me the confidence to start doing some of these other books.
When you write a book, what's your process? How do you go from idea to getting those words down on the page to final product? Just is it always the same, or is it different depending on the topic or how you're approaching it?
Yeah.
Just how do you go through and write those things?
So the next two were history books. And so I was in a dusty archive a lot, the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, doing a book called Whistle Stop on Harry Truman's 1948 campaign. And they were so convinced that he was cooked in that election that they stopped polling in mid-September.
Like, imagine that, right? If Gallup was crazy. No, we're calling it, he's fucked. So but he came back and won. And the way he did it was these 350 plus little train stops around the country. And there were these seven young guys feeding him information on each local town. So he could say, oh, dang, I was really sorry to hear about that fire, you know, you guys had a couple of years ago in your little downtown, but I hear you bounce back strong. Or if there was a baseball player from there, he would make a crack about the guy and how he was doing in the major leagues. And so he had all this kind of local information fed to him, and it really allowed him to connect. And he'd literally speak from the back of the train in each one of these little towns and connected enough with small town folk that he managed to win this election. So a lot of time in the archives, and then the National Churchill Museum in Fulton in Missouri is where Winston Churchill gave what he called his most important speech, called the Iron Curtain speech in 1946, which was really the first time either England or America told the truth about communist Russia and what they were up to. And so I wanted to tell the story of how the hell the most famous man in the world, the most famous British leader of all time, ended up in little town in rural Missouri, and what the speech meant that he gave there. So that was a lot different than working with Andy Galpin or Kelly Starrett, where it was mainly interview-based, Brian McKenzie, Fergus Connolly. And for those books, for the human performance books, I just challenged them. I said, guys, I need 10 chapter titles or 10 big topic areas. Can you do that? Yeah, okay, I can do that. So they put that in a Google Doc. And then, okay, I need 5 to 7 main talking points per chapter. Can you do that? Yeah, I can do that. They do that. And then I just interview them around it. And then from there, I research it and they send me some stuff. And I do a chapter, I send it. They do a quick edit, send it back. Then my good lady wife, Nicole, God bless her, edits all of my crap. and we lock the chapter and we knock them down, chapters 1 through 10. And at the end, you get either a phone book size book like Game Changer with Fergus, or you get a little book like Unplugged or like the 17-Hour Fast with Dr. Frank Merritt. And by the end, I've basically had a masterclass in fasting, in mobility, in physiology, in breath work from an Andy Galpin, from a Brian McKenzie. So I feel like I'm getting an education that should be costing me 6 figures a year from the absolute best in the world. And it's just a real blessing to be able to share that with people.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go through a couple of the books that you just talked about and maybe pull out one or two big takeaways, something that you went into it that you did not know prior to going into the book. So let's start with Game Changer.
So really, Fergus has this four-pronged approach to everything, really, and it's VIDC. So it's volume, intensity, density, and collision. And his point being that you can only prioritize one of these qualities if you're turning it up to 10 out of 10. You can maybe hit a couple like at 7 or 8, but you cannot turn them all up to the max. And he found that too many sports and college teams were trying to turn it to the max all the time and wondering why their injury rate was skyrocketing. Guys are burning out and they're not seeing the gains that they want to see off the field in the weight room or indeed on game day. And so really working backwards from game day, initially we were going to call it game day ready, working backwards from game day and understanding what the demands of game day are going to be and how often you're going to have to perform them in the season. And then figuring out what the load exposure needs to be to bulletproof people and then to develop these four, the VIDC quadrants, in a sensible and responsible manner that looks at the athlete as a whole human. And this was years before anyone was talking load management. Like, Fergus is so far ahead of his time with this stuff. And this was before, you know, I've done some writing for Smarter Base, which is now Teamworks, and they're doing an awesome job of quantifying. And they're also real smart about subjective data. But Fergus was way ahead on subjective data, dude, like just way ahead of his time on load management. And realizing that that does not just mean a guy gets a day off more, you know, and sits on the bench.
Right. So, right. What, let me ask you this. So your experience as a college basketball player, I'm going to just kind of compare and contrast it with mine and then with the theories that are being laid out in this book. Because I go back to, so I played college basketball from 88 to 92. I played at Kent State. And my coach, Jim McDonald, these concepts of whether you want to call it load management, whether you want to call it understanding the demands that are being placed on the body was not, we were completely old school. I mean, yeah. There was no discussion whatsoever of, hey, we might want to save these guys' legs, or, hey, Mike plays 37 minutes a game in the real games, but the day before practice or the day before a game, we're still going to have a 2.5 hour practice, or we're still going to have every single guy going full speed. And I can count the number of days off that we had that were unexpected days off in my 4 years. I could probably count them on less than one hand. Let's put it that way. And so it was just a completely different, there was no thought of, hey, how are you guys feeling? Or, you know, do we need to have a recovery day? Or maybe we should have the starters go a little bit lighter. Mm-hmm. There was none of that. How was it like for you with your team? Do you remember it being to that extent, or were you starting to see some changes in terms of the way that coaches prepared in your own personal experience?
The guy that really got me in good overall shape was outside of with John Owen Spicer, the rugby players I mentioned, was Steve, this old American coach that somehow ended up in Bristol and was coaching us knuckleheads. And he'd have us run the stairs up and down on an overpass, come back to the outdoor court, do 50 push-ups, go and do this agility drill in the grass with cones, run back to the overpass over the top of the motorway in Bristol. It was a busy city, you know, back down and just do these wicked circuits. So I think there's an element in Fergus's approach that is old school, like Steve. Like, he came out of the streets of Brooklyn, ran some AAU squads there, and the guy was relentless, just relentlessly hardcore, screaming at us. Kind of like, picture John Mosley, right, at ELAC. Like, if anyone's watched Last Chance U, and if you haven't, both as a model of a human being and a Christian-driven leader, check out John Mosley and Rob and their crew there. Yeah, man, I'm rewatching season 2, and holy crap, the guy's the best leader ever. But anyway, that aside, that was my John Mosley, and I needed him to kick my ass. Now, in college, Coach Cross was very much into old school periodization, very much into every sport has to Olympic lift, and very smart with not trying to make a football program into a basketball program. Because when you're being paid like $40,000 a year as an NAI strength coach, and you have 12 to 16 sports team, men and women, and you may have one or two grad assistants, and that's all you got, this is a different deal to what we see at Alabama football, North Carolina basketball, right?
For sure. Absolutely.
But he was able to nail the basics. Like Javorek, if anyone's listening that knows about Olympic lifting, you'll have heard the name Javorek. Like the complexes, complex 1, 2, and 3 in the weight room. We do that with the stick, right? Or the PVC pipe. We do it with the 45-pound bar. And if you're not nailing your complexes, he won't even let you put weight on the bar, dude. And Javorek was his mentor. Like, he was at Johnson County Community College, like, you know, one of the greatest minds ever in Olympic weightlifting worldwide. And so they had figured out together that we got to get these kids mobile. We got to, if they can't do an overhead squat with a stick, kind of like Gray Cook, you've got to move well before you can move often. And so I know guys, particularly some taller guys with long levers, that never put weight on the bar. It was stick and it was bar. And it was Javorek's complexes, and that's all it. And if they couldn't handle that, he would break the complexes down into dumbbells. And he had an old VHS tape, which is still doing the rounds amongst us old people, where the next coach, Whitney Rodden, I think, was the girl doing the movements. But he would lend those tapes out to people in the summer and be like, dude, just what do you have? And the guy would be like, oh, my dad's got a couple of rusty old dumbbells. Okay, I don't care you don't have a bar. Do these complexes 3 times a week, and guys will come back in phenomenal shape, man. It was basics. So basics and a smart mind.
Yeah, I think when you look at the way that things have transpired in the last 10 or 15 years and how much smarter everybody has become about what we need to be able to maximize performance, it really has been, I think, a huge benefit to the athletes that are playing. Again, it doesn't matter whether it's basketball or any other sport. I just think that as coaches, we just have a much greater understanding. There's so much more knowledge out there about what should be done. And yet you still have guys, obviously, like Fergus that you're talking about, that have this tremendous ability to think ahead, right? And just be on the cutting edge of that next thing because of the way they approach stuff. So I think that's really when I look at it, and I look at some of the biggest changes from back a long time ago when I was playing, and even in the early years of my coaching career, the way that we did things back then, you look at it now and you're like, man, how are we possibly thinking that we were maximizing either our own performance or the performance of our athletes, thinking about it as coaches. I always say this, you know, like when I was coaching my first year coaching high school, when I got my teaching job and I was an assistant varsity coach, we had a really young staff, and there'd be days where we'd practice like with high school kids, like 3.5 hours. Cause we had nowhere else to go, you know, none of us were married and you know, whatever. And it's just like, I look back on it like
the glory days, brother. You could,
exactly.
Jono or Spice, if I was working with Jono at the pub, shout out to the Spread Eagle Inn. Some good times there, both working and having a few beers, to be candid. But if we weren't doing that, then we'd be driving after a shift or a double shift to the rugby club. Or if Jono wasn't working with me, Spice would come pick me up. And like I said, we'd go hammer the sprints until we couldn't feel our feet, and then go and lift, right?
Right, yep.
And that was good times. And that was fun, man. Like, even the soundtrack from that, my oldest son's getting into System of a Down, right? And Spicer just played the song Toxicity. That was like our Eye of the Tiger, you know, for anyone that knows that. And so it just came to me the other day when we were on the way to work. I was like, you need a pre-work song, son. He's working at a coffee shop now and he's saving his money for college. So I see myself in that, but it triggered a memory. And I was like, here's your pre-workout song, and it's Toxicity. So sometimes you need that. And that was old school workouts, man. The same, my buddy Corey Maxwell, my buddy Asmar in college, and then Lucky, when we were lifting, we'd be in the weight room for 2 hours. Just, you know, one team would come in, you'd talk to your buddies there, and you'd maybe try to talk to a couple of girls and fail dismally. And then, you know, you just keep going. But it was the community aspect. Or you go down to the training room if you had a bit of a niggle, and just, it was almost like the small town I was from at a small college. And the fact that we had Coach Lamar and an amazing staff, some guys that were knocking on the door of being NBA level talent, like Dan Fleming and Aaron Harris. And then you also had, you know, Coach Rodden taking over from old Coach Cross in the weight room, and a great athletic training staff. Like, it was a mix of a small town, but a small town of experts. And so even at that point, I was gleaning everything I could from them.
Yeah, to be able to be in those environments, it's amazing how the number of people that you talk to, that so much of their success is set up by happenstance of just the people that they ended up being lucky enough to be coached by, or just to be around because of the situation, whether it's the school that they went to or the town that they grew up in or whatever it might be. And how much I don't want to say necessarily luck, because it's not always luck, but just the people that you get in contact with early in your career. And then if you take the time to build relationships with those people, all of that eventually just puts people in a position to be able to have success later in life. And I found that so often on the podcast, Phil, that you're just talking to people and it's like, boom, all of a sudden I'm like, man, this guy was coached by this famous coach way before that coach was famous. And then as that coach moved on up the ladder, then they remembered, hey, this kid played for me, or this guy was my graduate assistant. And boom, before you know it, it just kind of pays itself forward. It's amazing how that works.
It really is. And just an even soccer team, like my buddy Justin Wack and his wife Liz, she played women's soccer at Mid-America. It was the first year of the varsity there. Justin and I, you know, we live 2 minutes from each other. We're still great friends to this day, and our families and everything. But, you know, Dale Mitchell, Travis Emerson, my buddy Alfredo Orjuela, who moved back to Colombia. And at that point, if you were foreign and you could kick a ball to the wall, you were given a scholarship. Like, my brother thought it was the funniest thing ever, having played for Southampton FC, like, again, one of the top, you know, 20 teams in the world, in England, that someone would give me money to play soccer. But it was basically Jamaicans on the track team, Central and South Americans, and then a few Americans. And it was just a melting pot, man. And so to be able to hear from Alfredo about growing up in Colombia, like two of the cousins from Argentina. I'd never even met anyone from Argentina, bro. So just being able to be around
education,
these guys.
Right? The cultural education.
And Jamaica, to get down with the Patwan dialect and know when they were swearing about the coach and laugh about it on the bench and just
And coach would say first pass, free pass me, don't have to run anymore in the summer. Like the worst heat, dude, I've ever experienced in 2001. It doesn't get the triple digits in England, dude. So, or at least it didn't. And the Jamaicans could have run sideways. They probably could have crawled faster than everyone. And, you know, Jermaine was like a 45.1 400 meter runner. And I swear, dude, again, you don't think this at NAIA level. It's 104 degrees. Everyone's dying. And these guys are just jogging past you. And you're going as hard and fast as you can. So, I mean, anyone that's listening that has a son or a daughter and is thinking about schools, one, maybe your son or daughter is like me, like they're old school there. They want a small town environment. They don't want to be in a lecture hall with 500 people, like 20 people, 15 people in a class would do better. They got better access to professors. You want quality, value-driven education. Like look at somewhere like Mid-America Nazarene University. Like you get that education, you get that small town feel, and you get these friendships and mentorships that last for life. And sure, it may not open doors like a Harvard or Stanford, North Carolina, but there's something to be said for a small four-year liberal arts school, man. There's a lot to be said.
I think what you have to, what I realized after going through it as a parent, first with my daughter, who athletics was not a factor, and now going through with my son, who's going to be a senior in high school this coming year, and trying to help them to make decisions. One, I realized that my input or what I can contribute to those discussions is pretty small. Like when I went to school, I chose the only Division I scholarship that I had, and that was pretty much why I chose the school. There was
right.
I didn't really care about the professors, the campus, the this, the that. It was like, hey, this is a Division I scholarship. This is where I'm going to go. And so when I start trying to help my kids, I'm like, well, I don't know. And then neither one of them have, my son a little bit more than my daughter, my older daughter, but they don't have a clear picture of, I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be a doctor, or I want to be this. And so then you're like, okay, well, we're not looking for a specific program at a school because we don't really know what you're going to do. And probably chances are, even if you say you know what you're going to do when you're 17, you probably are going to end up somewhere else anyway. So it's just, it's hard to give, I find it to be hard to give good advice. And what I've found at least is, when you go and you visit the school, that it's more of a feel. Like you walk on campus and the kid's like, I feel like this would be a place that would be good for me. And it's not so much anything tangible. It's more a case of, it just feels right, at least in my two experiences to this point. So I think you're right though. You can find, I think there's a lot of places, big, small, NAIA, Division I, Division III. I think there's a lot of places that you can go to school and you can have a good experience and you can get out of it what you put into it ultimately. That's the message I always try to give my own kids.
And if you want to run sprints with Jocko Willink, go where my wife went, which is point. Sorry, Jocko, you're about to get invaded on your workouts when you and your wife are doing intervals. But the one time I interviewed him, he did let this slip. Twice a week, him and his wife go up early morning to the NAS, as he calls it, Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego. And if you walk on that campus, even if you don't know who Jocko is or wouldn't find that appealing, look out the ocean over the point there, right by Sunset Cliffs, and tell me that is not the best view in the world. And my wife got to go there for free, bro. So, yeah.
There you go. That works. Hey, so if you're going to school in San Diego, you're doing something right.
Yeah. And if you got any writers listening, Dean Nelson at the journalism program has written for the Boston Globe, the New York Times, LA Times. He's the best mentor I've ever had. So I'm doing some recruiting for these Nazarene school bros, and I'm not even a Nazarene.
Nice work. I like it, man. I like it. I like it. All right. Let's talk unplugged.
Yeah. So here's the premise. Stop outsourcing your decision-making to an inaccurate wearable device. Okay, so Michael Easter, who wrote a good book about how you got to do hard stuff and you got to carry heavy stuff, check out Michael Easter's work, recently did a little study and he found that the inaccuracy is very prevalent with wearables still. They've got way more sensors, they got oxygen meters and HRV and all this crap, and the least error rate he found was plus minus 8%. And he found that a $20 or less pedometer from Walgreens or CVS is more accurate at step counting than like a $1,000, I won't mention a brand because I don't want to piss anyone off, triathlete watch, should we say. And so if this device is a minimum of 8% accurate, inaccurate, sorry. So you're looking at 92% accuracy. And also you don't, are you really willing to put all your eggs in this basket? And what Brian McKenzie found, bro, was like, I'm getting a sleep score of 95 and I feel like shit. All right. I'm foggy. There's no amount of caffeine on the face of this good God's green earth that is going to help me. The next night, I get a 67 and I woke up on a tear. I woke up a bit early, went and crushed some eggs. And dude, I worked for like 8 hours straight with no caffeine. I was in a flow state. But if my watch's recommendation of don't train today, maybe back off on the work, if they've started tying some stuff into Slack now, dude, like Chris Winter, the sleep doctor, is kind of up in arms about this, as well he should be. If you need sleep advice, Chris Winter, Matthew Walker, those are your guys. But stop abdicating your decision-making to a device. So the three stages that we go through in Unplugged with Andy and Brian, and again, like just being able to mention these gentlemen is enough. Being able to work alongside them over the years is just a real blessing and a treat. So stage one is your coach or a device, say coach's eye was the one that was popular when we were writing this book. Your coach is using coach's eye, say, to film you. And they're like, bro, here's the freaking problem, right? Look at how your left knee is collapsing, or maybe both knees when you squat. That's gonna be a problem over time. So let's you show me what your starting foot position is on this squat. Okay. That's wrong. Okay, why is it wrong? Here's why it's wrong. Okay, let's look at your finish position where you're ending up. Because if, as Kelly Starrett says, if we can sort out how you entering the tunnel at the right angle and exiting the tunnel at the right angle, what happens in the middle is probably going to be okay, and you're not going to crash into the wall or another vehicle. Okay, so I'd learned this later from Kelly. So step two is, I'm going to have you redo it with your original faulty mechanics. Tell me if, when you get to that midpoint, if you can feel that knee starting to do something weird, and you're like, you do three or four, maybe it's just an air squat, and you're like, shit, that doesn't actually feel very good. I've never noticed that before. And it's probably because your body is like, there's some load on the bar, right? I'm trying to just get this thing up and down, not get stuck in the hole, pop back up, get the damn thing done, move on to the next set. But you've never noticed for whatever reason. So you feel that, right? You feel that. Yeah. Okay. Now let's do it my way. We're just going to groove the pattern unloaded. Okay. Do you feel that hitch now in your giddy up? No, coach. It actually feels way better. I'm not feeling that restriction. Okay. Now I want you to do it without me looking at it. And I'm not going to give you any cues. And eventually you go through this process to where there's more. You've used this app minimally as a tool, which it should be. It shouldn't be the main arbiter. It's been an experienced coach who is just backing up what he's seeing with some objective data to get my buy-in as that athlete. And now I've got you to the point of self-awareness where you can say, shit, that didn't feel very good unloaded. I can't imagine with 300-400 pounds what that's going to do to my knee over time. And now you're able to course correct. So we go from third-party tool being used by an experienced coach as a tool, not as a replacement for the coach. It will never, it should and will never happen. If I just don't see it, AI or this shit. No, it's just another tool in the toolbox. I've got now to the place of self-awareness where I recognize the faulty motor pattern. And stage three is I'm able to self-correct it now myself so that when I layer on speed, power, strength, I am not layering that on top of dysfunction, which over time is going to lead to injury. And even if it doesn't, it's going to compromise performance. That's Andy's three stages. So go check out his series with Huberman on the Huberman podcast. Go check out his stuff with Peter Attia on his podcast. And he says it way better than I do. But basically that's, and also our thing is, it's not a Strava fail. if your device doesn't log your workout. You still did the damn miles, bro. Your physiology knows. Like, hashtag Strava fail. Like, oh, Strava didn't work. Whatever shall I do? And it's not a knock on Strava. And Strava is doing an amazing job of data collection, and they're sharing these insights with the masses. It's a great company, and they have great tools. You know, Garmin's great. Suunto, Aura, Whoop, they're all great, but they are tools. I am using a microphone now. That is a tool. I am using Periodic Audio. Shout out to those guys. Periodic Audio headphones. I am using, we tried to use my Rode mixing desk, right? These are a tool. They're not having the conversation. You and I are having the conversation, and everyone at home is listening. Do you see the difference? Stop abdicating your decision-making to inaccurate devices. Use it in a minimal way to get the athlete to raise their self-awareness to the point where they feel the error, they recognize the error, and they are able to course correct by themselves without any tool or device needed.
Yeah, it's a great way to approach it. And I think it's something that people, as this new stuff has come online, people haven't really figured out the best way to utilize. And as you said, too often, I think people use it as a crutch, as sort of the tell-all of, this is the whole thing that everything that I'm doing is all about. And then if I'm not logging it, if I'm not checking it, if I'm not trying to meet whatever goals or criteria it's throwing at me, that I haven't had success. And that puts people in a difficult position. I know, just as an example, with my son back now, he's going to be a senior, but when we first started shooting on like a shooting machine, so this is probably when he's in like seventh or eighth grade, maybe when we started really taking the time and shooting, he'd get frustrated at the machine, like miscounted, or if it wasn't working accurately. It was almost like he didn't even want to do the workout if it wouldn't keep his stats. You know, like, I don't want to do that. You know, it's not keeping track. And you can understand that to some degree from a kid's perspective, that you want to add to your total and there's a leaderboard and all this stuff. And so you get it. At the same time, he's now gotten to the point, as he's matured and understood, that like the workout is the workout. It's not the end statistics. Don't tell the story of, hey, did I get better today? Like, I can go out on the court and be away from the machine and get more work, get things that are more realistic, that are going to translate more to my actual performance in a game than necessarily being on the shooting machine. There's a place for all of it, but it's just interesting that as you go through, to your point, you have to use it as a tool and not the be all end all.
Right. And Brian McKenzie and Emily Hightower and team are doing a great job with Shift, where there might be some tracking involved these days, but knowing Brian as I do, I doubt it. But if there is, it's just a little insight. But breath awareness, the quickest way to shift your physical, emotional, spiritual, mental state that we have available, and Patrick McKeown and others have done the research on this, so we know it. If you breathe in a certain pattern for 3.5 minutes, and the simplest way I found it, there's an HRV study. They compared a bunch of different patterns. And they found like 5.5 breaths a minute. So let's say 5 or 6, all right? So you breathe in, and I'm just talking about an even nasal inhale, not super deep. Oh, take a deep breath. No, that's actually moving the physiology the wrong way. Take a reasonably deep, you know, take a moderate breath in through your nose, and then go out through your nose and try to get to, say, 5 or 6 breaths a minute. You do that for 3.5 minutes, you have downshifted your nervous system from sympathetic fight, flight, or freeze into parasympathetic rest, digest, recover. You don't need a device, okay? Huberman did some great protocols for Whoop recently. So if you have a Whoop band, check out. I mean, Huberman's not playing. And the breath stuff he got mostly from Brian McKenzie, because they're good buddy. The only time I've had the pleasure of meeting Andrew was just in passing. His bulldog happened to be boarding at Brian McKenzie's house, and I happened to be staying with Brian. And I met Andrew before he broke cover, but I could see greatness in him, and he's had great success. But so if you need a device to guide you and you have a Whoop band, say, check out Andrew's protocols that you did with Whoop, because they're phenomenal. And again, look to Brian McKenzie and Emily Hightower at Shift for some other protocols. But it's what my friends Joe Linehorn and J.R. Smith at HANA, which is an Ayurvedic supplement company where they source everything from the Himalayan plateau. And if it's good enough for Jimmy Chin or for Travis Rice or for Ian Walsh, it's good enough for you. It's good enough for me. So top quality supplements. But we talk about ancient wisdom for modern living. So breath is the most underrated tool to tinker with your physiology out there. And a combination of Patrick McKeown, who I've learned from, and Brian McKenzie, and now Emily Hightower and others, and Jill Miller, Body by Breath, probably the best book in our field written in the last year. All these people have ways that you can twist knobs, move levers up and down, and make profound changes in your physiology. Now, you may start with a Whoop band with Andrew's protocols, or, you know, if Aura, Apple Watch, whatever has it built in, perfect, if you need the cue. But to Andy Galpin's point, try to get to the point where you recognize in your physiology, like, shit, I need to pause in the driveway because I'm not in a good headspace for my other significant other and my kids. And you breathe for 3.5 minutes through your nose, nice and slow. Don't even time the inhale and exhale, because that, if you're chronically stressed and anxious, that could make it worse. But just do what Patrick McKeown says, like nose first, shallow breath, like a, you don't want to be over breathing, and slow it down, like just nose and slow. Just think nose, close your freaking mouth. Your mouth is for talking, like we're yapping now, and for eating. It's not for breathing. Take 3.5 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes just to breathe. Be grateful for your day. Be thankful you came home in one piece and got through rush hour. Then go in. Before work, you've got a big board meeting and you've got to present whatever, a big sales presentation. Take your 3.5 minutes, nose breathe, don't do it super deep, do it slowly. Stop counting it, just, okay, I'm just going to pause for a couple of minutes. I'm not going to look at the time. Maybe it's not even 3.5 minutes. You will start to shift your physiology. You don't need a device, and it's a portable practice. You're nervous about flying. Nose breathe your way through it and notice the difference in how you feel in your mind and in your body. So the most powerful practice, dude, you do not start if you must, if you don't know the protocols, if even this was too complex for you. And Brian says it better, Andrew, Jill Miller, Patrick McKeown, all of these. Look up these people's, read their books. But their most basic protocols, Brian would say, you don't need a book I've written. Jill would say the same thing. Look at their YouTube. Look at a freaking Instagram reel for 10 seconds of Jill Miller doing a nasal breathing exercise, dude. It's all you need. Shift your physiology and get to the point where you know how to tweak the inhales, the exhales, the pauses in between, maybe a bit of box breathing like the Navy SEALs, whatever it is. But get to the point where you don't need the tech anymore and be like, thanks Whoop, thanks Andrew Huberman, now I can do it alone. Because Huberman would say, I want you to get to the point, Kelly Starrett says this, you should be able to perform basic maintenance on yourself. That's his whole, do 10 minutes of mobility a day, every day. Okay. Aaron Alexander, in our book Align, go for a walk every day. Get out in nature unplugged every day. We got some real simple stuff in that book. Check out Aaron's work, and there's 10 protocols in there. They're all saying the same thing, and we're going away from, oh, it tracks 240 data points? Amazing. I'm going to drop $1,000 on this thing and my $50 a month. No, start there. But to Andy Galpin's point, become independent of the device. If you have it there, sure. Do you want to confirm or deny an assumption? Disprove a hypothesis, maybe? Sure. It has a place. But a lot of these things, breath work is portable. Mobility is portable. GoRuck has a new kettlebell that's basically a canvas bag that you can take to the beach or a lake and fill with sand. Portable tool, to Michael Easter's point. So the lessons I've really learned from everyone from Fergus to all the gentlemen and ladies I just talked about, they're all trending towards ancient wisdom and simplicity. And yeah, so just check out any one of their work 10 seconds at a time and do likewise. Or as Pavel says at Strong First, do your swings and do your get-ups, right? Your simple and sinister. Or how often? Just repeat until strong.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder, Vlad Moldovanu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, HoopHeads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
I think simplicity, when you start talking about that, and again, it becomes really easy to get drawn in by all those fancy bells and whistles. And as you said, hey, this thing can measure 240 data points. Woohoo, that's so exciting. But the reality is that, look, most of what we know about how our body and our mind functions the way that it should is fairly simple, right? We know what we should do, but we're always looking for this next sort of trick and thing that we think is going to make it miraculously turn out the way we want, where really it's things that are simple to do. They're not always easy to do, yeah. But well, they're simple to do.
Well, look at, and they all say, they all agree. Like if you got Gray Cook in a room and Dan John and Kelly Starrett and Aaron Alexander, Jeremy Bethel is another one at Variant out in Santa Barbara, who's amazing at systems thinking, like Fergus. If you put everyone I've mentioned in a room, we're all going to agree on 95, 98, 99% of this stuff. Huberman, everyone. Even the sleep guys, like if you look at Huberman's light and dark exposure, okay, get out in the morning in a bit of sunlight. If it's cloudy, do it for longer with no sunglasses. Aaron Alexander would then say expose little skin to get more vitamin D synthesis going. At the other end, Chris Winter told Tim DeFrancesco on the Basketball Strong podcast episode, he once had a pro athlete start using a headlamp. Like a runner's headlamp that you would use if you were running at night or on an ultra like Leadville, and turn off all overhead lights and lamps. And suddenly the guy didn't have insomnia anymore and could actually sleep. I think it was an NFL player. Limit your light exposure. Replace all these horrible bright LEDs with Edison bulbs because the light spectrum is better. Get off your devices 2 hours before bed. Limit alcohol to 2 drinks, cut off caffeine. The whole cutting off caffeine, like at noon thing, like Fergus and I were drinking coffee at 10 p.m. when we were working on Game Changers. So I'm a little, take some Doc Parsley sleep remedy if you're going to do that, you know?
Part of that is knowing your own body too, right? Yeah, some people have different reactions.
Don't even get me started. Like I work with some ex-Navy SEALs and they're all morning people and I love it. I love it. It's great. I am not, they're up for 4 hours before I am, maybe five. But I have worked until 5 a.m. and gotten up at 7 a.m. for a full-time job and done that until my heart hurt for 3 to 6 months at a time, multiples. I'm deadly serious.
That's how I like to do it too. I am definitely, if I'm going to get up and what I like about working at night, honestly, Phil, is the only cutoff is when I decide I'm going to go to bed. If I'm working in the morning, then my cutoff is
when your kids,
my kids are awake or, yeah, or whatever.
And
I'm not in control of that deadline. Yeah. Whereas at night, I'm in control of that deadline.
And you're not stealing time from your family.
Correct.
And God knows I have. To my detriment, I have. And from my wife. Because these books require, I love them. And I laid out, if anyone was listening, they want to write a book, hit me up for advice if you want, for free advice, but I just gave you my whole blueprint of how to do a book. Now I will give you what Dan John's coach told him about how to throw hammer and discus at the college level. He said, you're going to weight train 3 times a week. You're going to go to track practice 2 or 3 times a week. Can you do that? Yeah, I can do that, coach. .. for 8 years. that's the part Dan says that people don't want to do. Like, they're like, yeah, exactly. I can do that weekly for 8 years. And the history books, which maybe one day I'll get a chance to do another one, take 3 or 4 years, you know. Game Changer took us at least 2. These things take a while, but to your point, find out about yourself. You don't have to do 60 hard or 30 hard or whatever it is. You don't have to be a morning person. And I think more non-morning people get shamed into it, and it can actually bugger their physiology. Stephen Kotler, who wrote The Rise of Superman, told me one time, it was for Unplugged, actually. I don't even think it made it in the book. He was like, every writer I know is up before everybody, or, he did not say and, or they are up later than everybody. And that is when not only their physiology tells them it's time to rise and grind or time to stay up and grind, but it's when, as to your point, when does your schedule allow for a flow state to happen? What playlist do you want to curate to drop yourself into flow? Who are your musical artists? Even if you want to do like an auto-generated Spotify thing or whatever, who are your artists? And game that to the point where you don't hear the music anymore. Get some really good noise-canceling headphones. Get a quiet space. And even if you have to carve out 30 minutes, dude, because you're tired, try to do that 3 or 4 times a week. It's like your workouts, right? Enough time to drop into a flow state. Find out when your physiology is best, not when David Goggins is telling you you're a pussy and you need to get up. And I'm not mocking Goggins. He's awesome.
No, I know what you mean.
And he would
kick
my ass. And if you heard that, maybe you will. So whatever. But you don't have to get up at 4 or 5 p.m. to be successful or to write books. And at the same time, have a functional family, kind of. And only joking, kids. And also a full-time job.
Exactly. There's a lot of balance. I will say that in my own life, what I've sacrificed, I haven't been willing to sacrifice family. And to your point, there are certainly times where I do things that, you know,
oh, I know. With my
family. But for the most part, again, I try to do things late at night when everybody goes to bed, and what I've sacrificed is sleep. And that's just the reality of the certain time that you're in your life, that if you want to do, and again, I think everything is probably too big of a word, but if I want to try to do as many things as I would like to do, then something has to be sacrificed to some degree. And I found myself figuring out how to function on probably less sleep than I should if I really want to.
And even beyond the sleep piece, which is super important, and I can sleep for days. My wife's like being on out of town. It's been glorious. I sleep before I saw Yui share a car, so she's in Kansas with the kids. I walked 30 minutes to the coffee shop where my son's working, had a chat with the boss, reminded her that he needs more shifts to save money for college, like we were talking about earlier. And then I walked back, and it's a mountain view. It's right by the lake. We're really blessed where we are. But even if you lived in a city and it's busy and noisy, put your headphones in, do what you need to do. Walk to the coffee shop instead of driving there. So that's one good change to make, get you more movement in every day. And be willing to sacrifice that time too. But cut back, be honest about your device usage, right? You should have my friend Kenny Kane on the show, and he's trained Joakim Noah. He's trained a lot of late career NBA guys and kept them healthy. Kenny and I did a lot of pieces for Train Heroic, and some of it was self-experiment. Some of it was diving into Cal Newport stuff with deep work and digital minimalism. And Kenny's question, if any coaches listening, do you want your athletes to be more fit, healthy, and well, or not? Okay. Are these social media platforms making them more fit, healthy, or well, or are they not? Honest answer. Okay. Is the time that you are devoting to bigging yourselves up on these platforms making yourself more fit, healthy, or well? And I would add, giving you more quality time with your family or less. And really what we get to is digital minimalism, Cal Newport's book, where I want people to hear from Tim DeFrancesco on the Basketball Strong podcast and from our awesome guests. I'm just the setup guy that does the research. So I like to write about that stuff. I want people to read and learn from my co-author, Dr. Jim Aframo, in The Leader's Mind. So I tweet about that. But I literally get on there, I'll repost somebody else's stuff, I'll like a few things or give a supportive comment and try to show some positivity to a Mike Boyle or Dan John or another mentor or friend, but I'm capping it at 5 minutes a day. And it's a one-time deal. Honestly assess how many minutes a day you are on the socials. And if, again, if you're a coach, what is that doing to your family life and doing to your ability to make your clients fit healthy and well? Just think about it.
It's a great question. I think it's something that, especially right as parents, it's something that you become acutely aware of when A, you think about your own usage, and then B, you try to think about your kids' usage and how to manage it.
And they don't have a phone. Is the answer. Yeah,
My kids didn't get one. So my son got his when he was in 10th grade. My daughter got hers when she was in 9th. And they complained probably for 3 years before that they were the only people in their grade that didn't have a phone.
And you and your wife did the thing where you're not trying to be best buds with them all the time.
Correct.
So you didn't drop $1,800, which on a freaking Samsung Galaxy Fold, like somebody just shoot me in the face.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it not enough that we got 16-year-olds driving around Colorado in brand new BMW X7s? That's a problem. But Shane Trotter's done a lot. His book, Setting the Bar, he talks about a lot of different things, and he gets into this just a little bit. But if you look at Tristan Harris at the Center of Humane Technology, you look at Cal Newport, the guys have done the research on this, and Tristan was the one that was behind the documentary on Netflix, right, on social media, which is awesome. You should check it. Past a certain point, these socials and being addicted to this device, it was deliberate, and it's extractive. It is an extractive attention economy designed to enrich Mark Zuckerberg and company, and they knew what they were doing, and they did it anyway to our kids. Willingly and knowingly to increase profit margins. And their only goal is to get you on the platforms as many times a day as possible and get you to stay as long as you can and to engage at a higher level and to share more of your data points so that they can target and sell ads. And Zuckerberg said it in front of a congressional subcommittee. Senator, we sell ads. And boy, do they ever. These people do not have human goals in mind. They do not have the mental well-being of your kids in mind. And when 90% of Gen Z, per Psychology Today, is anxious, depressed, or even suicidal most of the time, we have a real problem. And you giving your kids a device, you are part of the problem. Be the adult in the room. And say no. And if you say, well, I have a daughter and we live in kind of a dangerous city and she has a practice, and what if it's canceled and no one else is around and she shows up and she needs to tell me to come pick her up? Punked phone, flip phone, dumb phone is a smartphone, right? And that's an option. They do not have the fortitude. These are not David Goggins and Jocko Willink and Commander Rourke Denver. These are not Navy SEAL commandos. They have not led men into battle, sometimes to die. They do not have the average adult I know, the average coach I know, does not have the fortitude to self-limit. So you can get an app that will set a hard limit for you. It will just cut you off and darken the screen. You're 5 minutes a day, you're 10 minutes a day. And if you're a coach and you're like, I have to be on there for my business, like Tim DeFrancesco does a great job with this. He puts out his exercise video or his little truth about nutrition. Again, he'll do some positivity and share some stuff from his buddies in the industry who are doing a great job, and he gets the hell off and he spends more quality family time than almost anyone I know, any father I know. So yeah, just do the bare minimum to get new clients, to keep clients, to celebrate your athletes, to share your knowledge and mentor at scale in a minimal fashion. And you've got to get honest with yourself. And if you can't speak truth into your life, get your pastor, get a mentor, get a good friend to be like, what do you think of my social media usage? What do you think of what have you noticed about me since I started bringing my phone to when we have a beer occasionally or dinner? Just level with me, dude, and then start figuring out how you can minimize.
Isn't it amazing to think back 20 years ago that nobody had one of these things? And today,
and Yellow Pages was a thing.
There's a guy selling a house in Evergreen. It's $21 million. Our realtor's selling it. I don't know why he plays with us. They got a Bugatti Veyron and 34 other sports cars. And you know where that money came from? It's the Yellow Pages fortune. Any kid listening to this is like, what the hell is Yellow Pages, bro?
That's funny. I was watching actually my youngest daughter, who is 13. We watched Back to the Future.
Sweet.
Last night. And so Michael J. Fox is going in, he goes in the phone booth and he's looking, rifling through the Yellow Pages, and he tears out a page to try to find Doc Brown's phone number. And my daughter, I can see, just, she's looking at the screen and just completely confused and perplexed by what she's seeing up there. Like, what is this phone booth? And there's a book with phone numbers. It's amazing to me just how different when you go out into a social setting and you see people, and every person is dialed into that phone. It's incredible. And you understand, again, that's what it's designed to do, right? It's designed to be addicting.
Yes.
And yet we all have to be willing to put it down.
And don't get me wrong. Like, if we like to drive, say, like Coronado Island, we'll blow some hotel points of a summer. You know, we stop in St. George, Utah. It's a good like 16, 17, 18 hour drive. And the kids have a little portable DVD player, which is an absolute piece of crap. And on full volume, they can barely hear it. So they'll watch some DVDs. It's not built in. It's just literally stuck between the front seats. And occasionally, you know, we hope it doesn't,
one of those,
whoever's driving, it doesn't fall in their lap and then we kill everyone. So we got one of those. But there's, for some reason, Mazda saw it fit to not put a CD player in our little CX-5. We've always shared a pretty cheap car. And so I don't have a choice. We either run an iPod. I bought everyone a ClickWheel iPod a few years ago, which is freaking glorious. I love that thing. With wired headphones, by the way. None of this freaking Bluetooth crap. But then, you know, Apple Music is quite handy, or Spotify, to set a playlist, and one of the kids hits go and it just runs for 8 hours in between the movies. So, dude, not saying it doesn't help, and I'm so directionally challenged, as we all are these days. I need the directions a lot of the time. But I wish there was somewhere in between where it did, you could get Apple Music or whatever, Spotify, you could have directions and it had text and phone, and that's literally it. It's literally it.
There's your next new invention.
Well, I mean, Punk'd is doing a good job. Like, they put an MP3 player on theirs and it looks badass. But I'm pretty sure the navigation part isn't there, and I guess you could get away without streaming music, but yeah, the navigation part isn't there. So if they ever add that, I will smash this iPhone with a hammer the first day. I swear to gosh. But it's not about being a Luddite. Like, Andy Galpin's got a lot of shade on this from people about, oh, so you and Mackenzie and whoever that stupid British writer guy are, you're just saying the wearables suck. I'm an idiot for using them. And it's like, no, we're just trying to say, get to the point of self-awareness, which should then lead to self-regulation. And as a coach, your job is to empower your clients to get to that point.
Yeah, I think it just comes down to, again, it's whether it's the phone, whether it's a fitness app, whether it's a tracking device, whatever it is, that it has to be a tool that you use to better yourself, better your life, as opposed to something that you are attached to 24 hours a day, that you can't live without, that you're constantly looking at, staring at, that it is taking the place of the human beings in your life. And I think that's what it comes down to. And we could boil it down and talk about a million other different ways to approach it. But ultimately, it's learn how to be responsible for yourself in lots of different ways. And if you want to use these things as a tool to supplement, that's where you want to be. You don't want to be in a case where that is dictating what you do.
And yet these new like traffic light systems on phones or on devices, red is stop, yellow is pause, you know, green is go, or yellow may be proceed with caution. And yet it's coming out of a place, you cannot just look at HRV, dude, or an arbitrary sleep score that takes HRV and then allegedly tells you how long you spend in each sleep stage. Allegedly. Get Chris Winter or Matthew Walker on the show and ask them how accurate they think this shit is. And I'm going to tell you, not very.
you know, actual sleep doctors, PhDs in sleep. What do I know? What do I know about any of this? I've just happened to glean from some smart people. And the way I can serve is by hopefully putting it into words on a page where some people can benefit. And that's my way to serve, man. But it comes down to a binary opposition. I can play with my kids. We can play at Uno, the three of us with my wife, or we can play Monopoly or Masterpiece, one of those great games from the 70s or 80s, or we can all sit around on our phones. It's not both. It isn't. You can go and shoot hoops with your kid in the driveway, or teach them how to hinge or squat, lunge, whatever, push press, you know. Or you can be effing around on the gram or on, who knows what, some freaking thing called Be Real now. God help us. God help us. Apparently it's set, you can set challenges on there where it's like you have to post every 30 minutes or every 15 minutes. And kids that work with my son are getting away with doing this when it's slow. And they're like, right. why don't you have working. This? Yep. And he's like, my dad won't let me have a phone because he's a crazy old guy. And it's like, but they don't want it. They don't want it, ultimately. So if you're doing Be Real challenges every 15 to 30 minutes, would you rather, I mean, do you want that on your tombstone? He ignored his kids and his wife, but he was real good on Be Real for his four followers.
Right. Here's his pictures. Here's his four bazillion pictures for the last 10 years that he's posted.
Jim Aframo and I did a great, we had Gabby Reese on and we had Laird Hamilton on Champions Conversations, which we've paused because we're deep into book land again, which is kind of fun. But Gabby was saying there's a mass delusion going on at the airport. These teenagers all think they're famous. The way they act, the way they're having their friends stage photos of them, or they're right. staging selfies, or they're going live. Like, Gabby Reese is pretty famous. Her shoe for Nike was the first female signature Nike shoe, and it outsold Air Jordans. She's pretty damn famous, and she is not going live or doing reels or doing whatever the hell it is at the airport. She is going to get a coffee and actually having time to read a book for once, she told us. So listen to that episode. And then Laird had something to say about, on Tim Ferriss's podcast, Tim Ferriss always closes with, where can people find you? You know what Laird said? Did he say Instagram? Did he say Twitter or Facebook? Be Real. He said three words. The Pacific Ocean. That's where you can find him.
There you go.
And if
That's
you think, if you follow Laird Hamilton on social media, he ain't doing that account. Sorry to burst your bubble, but he is not. He doesn't know how to use it. I can tell you with dead certainty. Having worked with him and Gabby at XBT. So
That's funny.
The Pacific Ocean. You can find me in the mountains of Evergreen, Colorado is what I want. And frankly, if I wasn't trying to make it so the burden of marketing wasn't all on Tim for the podcast, for Basketball Strong, or for Jim for the Leader's Mind, I would not be on there at all. I just wouldn't.
Yeah, like I only use whatever social media I have. I have only ever posted things that are related to my basketball camp business or my podcast. I don't think I've ever once put up a photo of me on vacation, of my kids doing this or that. I just, that to me, like anybody who wants to see that stuff, I have enough of a relationship with them that they could just come to my house and I could show them pictures or have a conversation with them.
Here's the deal, dude. When we were going back and forth on trying to get this thing going, you could have gone on Twitter and had a thousand micro interactions, some of which would have been meaningful, some of which less so, and so could I, or we could do this. You know, like I could have...
Absolutely.
I could have driven, if we had two cars, which we don't, I could have driven to to a drive-through and not talked to my son's co-workers and his boss a little bit and not plodded back, you know, up the mountain. But I would have been missing face-to-face contact because my wife and kids are out of town. I would have had no face-to-face all day. And also, you and I could get stuck in having only transactional conversations,
where we're applying for a job. I'm trying to get a new book off the ground. We're doing these interviews, which are awesome, but it's somewhat transactional. But when was the last time you sat down with a friend and you looked up 4 hours later and like, man, where did the time go? Because your phone is locked in your house or in your glove box. You didn't even bring the damn thing, dude. Like, don't you miss that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I say to people is at the end of a podcast interview, one of the things that I always say to people is, you know, I hope that what happens as a result of the podcast is that there's a genuine relationship that happens. And obviously it doesn't happen every single time, but there's a ton of people that we've had as guests on the show that, you know, I now consider to be a friend. And some of them I've met in person. Some of them I've had deeper, longer conversations with that are not part of the podcast. Sometimes it's just as simple as me checking up on, hey, how's their team doing, and sending them an email or that kind of thing. And that doesn't have, because I say to people, how often, when's the last time you had a conversation with someone that lasts between an hour and an hour and a half, where you just sat down and you just talked to them for that length of time? I mean, you almost never do that.
I mean, I think that's why Ferris got popular, Rogan, Huberman, because people are using it as a proxy for the lack of deep conversation in their own life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right.
And that's not to say, I mean, all those guys, dude, like, one, we wish we could have like a thousandth of their followers, but it's good on them. Like, the revenge of long form, like this notion of no one reads books anymore. It's bullshit. People have a desire for story in their life, and they have a desire for conversation in their life, because that's how we make meaning out of the world. And so, do you want to do more or less of that? Because if you want to do more of that on a deep level, you need to do less of the superficial shit that really doesn't matter very much. And again, but you don't get it, dude. Like, I do, it's all online coaching. Cool. 5 to 10 minutes a day, and then get the hell off and be disciplined. And if you can't, find an app that will kick you off, because they do exist.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's something that you have to be disciplined about. And sometimes even when we know that we should, you find people that just, they can't help themselves.
Well, it's like I know I should sleep 7 to 9 hours, you know, whatever it is, 6.5 hours to 9.5 hours at night. Are you, though? Like, how many million Americans are hooked on sleep pills, have chronic conditions, or are just messed up sleep? Like, it isn't clinical. We all know we should walk. The 10,000 steps a day was made up by a Japanese scientist who realized that his peers his age were not walking enough, and then a clever company realized that with the Tokyo Olympics, they could probably make some coin off of making something that would encourage people to walk more. And these clubs literally sprung up around Japan where people would get together and walk outside. That's pretty awesome, but it was the most basic pedometer in the wake of the Tokyo Olympics. But it's interesting that the actual 10,000 steps, an exercise physiologist pulled it at Tokyo, pulled it out of his ass, and then a company globbed onto it. And now it's become gospel, but we all know we should walk every day, at least some. Do we? No. Okay.
Easy. It's
basics.
So, right. Like, simple, we just simple, don't, we simple, don't but do not, them, simple, though. But not easy.
We yeah, don't
simple,
do them.
But not easy. You're right. We don't.
And people like Chris Winter, like on sleep, might get some criticism for being too basic, or Matthew Walker, like, yeah, I know, cut off caffeine by this time, don't drink too much, you know, cut off screens 2 hours before bed, try to, you know, have consistent sleep wake times, get morning sun exposure. Are you? Go down Huberman's sleep protocol or circadian rhythm protocol, where he starts off with morning sunlight and he ends with what you should do at night. Tell me how many of those you are currently doing or not doing. And let's check those off before we get to any kind of complexity.
Yeah, I mean, if you could master the basics, right? It's just like an athlete. You have to master the basics of what you need to do. And once you master the basics, then is there some things that you can do once you get to that basic level that can level you up a little bit? Sure. But so many people are focused on the things that aren't important until you master the basics. And I think there's, I don't know how you fix that, just other than continuing to preach the message as much as you can.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, also take a look at what is coming out of the military, whether it's from veterans, like Jocko Willink, like Rourke Denver, like Goggins to some extent, or even from people that they commanded. So Ryan Birdman Parrott has a charity for burn victims. Started off, it was just military, and now it's kids as well, civilians, and has just devoted his post-Navy SEAL sniper career to helping burn victims. But really, what they did a project called 7X and the Human Performance Project, and they were looking at what would happen if we got a bunch of messed up veterans and some pro athletes in extreme sports who were dealing with addiction and divorce and all this stuff, life stuff. And we took them to all seven continents and we ran 7 marathons in 7 days. We did 7 skydives in 7 days. And it's ultimately, it wasn't trying to recreate the stresses of the battlefield, but just saying, like, some of the stuff that emergency services personnel or service members in our military deal with day in, day out for 20 plus years, life is chaos, right? So what are some of the basics we can do to get people to perform in very suboptimal conditions where good consistent sleep is not an option, good consistent nutrition might not be an option? They're sure not tracking stuff when guys are in Fallujah. I can tell you on the ground, they just can't, because it's data security. The enemy could hack into that and find the location of the SEAL team, you know, that took out bin Laden. How well would that have gone if bin Laden knew they were coming? Not well. That's why they weren't wearing a device, right, to track them. They were just doing comms and their weapons. So to me, a lot of the stuff that comes out of the military, and they're starting to figure out, like with POTF, with H2F, whether it be a joint command with SOCOM, or it's the big military, how to do these things at scale. And the people running H2F programs for a whole battalion, POTF for a whole battalion, look at some of the shit coming out of there, some of the basics of how you can perform optimally and not just survive, but thrive in less than optimal conditions or very adverse conditions. Because that's what's starting to fascinate me. Because in sports, if I'm at Manchester United, not just my first team, but my academy players are going to want manicured grass. They're going to want cryo chambers. They're going to expect wearable tracking. They're going to want everything. Or even fighters. I know I've heard stories of fighters where their music didn't play or didn't start at the right time, their entrance music, and it threw them off their game and they got their ass kicked or they got knocked out, because everything has been optimized to the degree. And Andy Galpin says you can't always be optimizing. So to me, not just look at what Andy and Dan Garner and Doug Larson, the guys from Barbell Shrugged, are doing, Anders Varner, but look at what some of the stuff that's coming out, again, either from retired commanders like a Rourke Denver or from people like Ryan Birdman Parrott, who's a SEAL sniper, and then look at what they're doing with people that are still in the service to figure out what are the big rocks, but from a different perspective, because life is chaos. And as Andy says, you can't always be optimizing. So therefore, what are the big rocks you need to get in place through the lens of chaos and adversity?
Right. That's ultimately what coaches are trying to do, is be able to figure out, how can I get my team to be adaptable, to be able to play their best under challenging circumstances? And
Bob Bowman,
that's what coaches are always trying to strive for.
Bob Bowman, why did Michael Phelps, people think this only happened at the Beijing Olympics. That is wrong. It happened at the World Championships the year before. Goggles started to slip or fill with water on one side. Suddenly they fill on the other side. And I believe it was either the Olympics or the World Championship race. He swam 175 meters out of a 200 meter race without being able to see. And he won the gold medal, which was part of his eight medal, you know, to beat Mark Spitz's record of 7, and gave him the most Olympic medals of all time and the most golds of all time. And he broke the world record. And they beat Lochte and he beat Peter Cech. How? One time in Maryland. Or actually, no, they were training in Michigan at the time with Bob Bowman. The power went out and Bowman said, keep going. He said it was good. Phelps talked about this in his book, No Limits. And then Bowman took it a step further where he would sometimes just randomly turn the lights off when they were training and be like, keep going, full pace, count your strokes, know when you need to turn. And then he started blacking out Phelps's goggles with a Sharpie, one eye, left eye, right eye, both eyes. So when he got to the World Championships in Australia and it happened, he won the race. I don't think he set the world record. He won gold. And then in Beijing, the ultimate test. And you saw him, dude. Like, he would go from a race back to the practice pool and have active recovery swim, and then he'd have to go out and do another race. Like, what in the hell is going on? It's not like in the if someone doubled up, say, Michael Johnson, the 200 and 400 or whoever, where the heats are not for another 3 or 4 days. And I'm not saying that isn't demanding, because Michael Johnson's Michael Johnson. He's an incredible coach now, as well as a, you know, a legendary track athlete. But Phelps was literally doing one final, having a couple of hours to get some food down and go swim again, and then having to go into the heat or a semi-final for another event. And how did he deal with adversity? Bob Bowman is how.
Figuring out ways to be able to simulate those things,
yes,
that might occur in training, right? That might occur in competition, and figuring out, how do I simulate and put my athletes under stress in practice in lower stakes environments, so that when they get to a situation where they have to perform at the highest level, that they've pretty much had every single thing thrown at them that they could to be able to be at their best and at their peak when their peak is necessary. And I think that's what, again, that's what coaches are trying to do. You're trying to get your athletes, your teams, to perform at their very best when their very best is needed. And how do you do that? You keep just trying to give them different stimuli, different challenges, different obstacles that they have to overcome.
Yeah.
And that's what the very best coaches do. And that's the art of coaching.
Yes.
I mean, obviously there's a ton of science behind it, but ultimately coaching comes down to, you have to have an understanding of the science, but you also have to have the touch, the art of coaching,
yes,
in order to be a truly successful coach.
And going back to Coach John Mosley, you know, he had the player who he found out was autistic, and he was just starting to put a bigger burden on this kid and think he could be our starting power forward. I got to shuffle my lineup because they were losing, and they should not be losing with the talent they had on that. And this is season 2, Last Chance U Basketball on Netflix. But he realized that he was coaching this kid wrong, because a recruiter said, you know, how's he doing with his autism? And he was like, what the hell are you talking about? And he was like, yeah, he has autism. And he realized that his context, when the kid said, coach, I don't understand, he would make everyone stop and run sprints because he thought he was being disrespectful or being lazy. But he wasn't. And a lot of the time it was sensory overload, to the point where the kid told the assistant coach, I can't come into practice today. I'm already overstimulated. I can't deal with the shouting, the bouncing balls. So that's context. And like Kenny Kane, I mean, Brett Bartholomew does a great job too, but Kenny Kane was the first one to coin this. And unfortunately, other people kind of stole his stuff and put it into their books. But contextual coaching, like knowing that stuff, or fight, and Mosley felt terrible. And since then has, you know, communicated differently and got the best out of this kid and served him better as a human. But if a coach knows that a guy is going, or a girl is going through a divorce, or if they're younger, a breakup, that has an impact. If they know there's a life situation going on, they're coaching a college athlete and they're trying to switch schools in the transfer portal, say, that's a big thing. If you're trying to go from college, you know, you think, oh, I actually want to be closer to my family on the East Coast, I'm in California, that's a multi-thousand mile move. That's a huge deal, right? Or a cyclist, maybe they're training a cyclist who's trying to get on the junior tour in Europe, say, that's a big life thing. You got to, part of the art of coaching is what Kenny Kane calls contextual coaching. And it's what Fergus would call human first coaching as well. We got to know the context. And if you do find something out, actually act on the information, like Coach John Mosley and like Rob and all the assistant coaches there, and have a heart for this kid and pretty much apologize to him. Like, dude, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And from now on, it's going to be different. And then put that into action. The same as we do with our kids. But you have to ask questions, and you have to be actively involved in listening to the answers. And you can't do that if you're on a device.
That's absolutely true. And I think it goes to whether you're in a work situation, whether you're in a coaching player situation, whether you're in a parent-child situation, all those things are completely are completely true. And you have to be willing to invest in the other person. And you can't invest with somebody when you're relying upon a device. You just can't.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about the Basketball Strong podcast.
Yeah. So Tim DeFrancesco, for those not in the know, his first 4 years with the Lakers were Kobe Bryant's last 4 years. So he was helping Kobe rehab under the guise of Gary VD, of course, who was in charge of sports medicine there and was basically like everything. It was a one-man show for many years. So yeah, check out the episodes with Gary VD. They're pretty fun and really candid. Some good Shaq and Kobe stuff and Phil Jackson in there, and just a great human, a wonderful storyteller. But so Tim also had a lot of young players like Julius Randle, who had this horrendous bone break. I think my son has Julius Randle's rookie card, and I think it's like 8 points. And he's like, "Dad, why does Julius Randle have like, you know, thousands of points now and he only had 8 in his rookie year?" And I'm like, "Well, son, ask Tim sometime." And he had a lot of younger guys, Brandon Ingram, who, you know, these guys are going to be busts. Well, he started putting in the foundation that, you know, eventually would help Brandon Ingram become an all-star, would help Julius Randle become an all-star. And they were not, in fact, busts. They were just really young and had never strength trained. And so, yeah, so Tim and I started doing, I would ghostwrite for him a bit for Train Heroic, and then started doing a bit for his blog. And he wanted to restart a podcast and rename it. And so we came up with Basketball Strong. And, you know, we have the best starting point is Henry Barrera, who is now with Alabama men's basketball, but was at Liberty U for a long time. On a gut level, a soul level, listen to Henry Barrera's life story, the first 20 minutes of that, and tell me that you are not moved to the depths of your soul. That's what we're going for. Like, we've had some big names on. We've had Meta World Peace on our test. That will be episode 100. I think we've had Byron Scott on. We've had Judd Bushler telling us firsthand what it was like in Michael Jordan's first practice back from retirement. What it was like to be part of that group with Scotty and Dennis Rodman and Phil. And so we've had some, in quotes, big names. But yeah, start with Henry Barrera. I think it's episode 3. Yeah, and we're really just trying to, even if someone's listening doesn't like basketball, there's just some great human stories there.
It's fun. That's one of the things that we've enjoyed the most about our pod too, is just getting a chance to allow people to tell their stories. And just like you, we've had some big names on, but I get as much pleasure out of talking to a high school coach from wherever that nobody's ever heard of that has a story to tell.
Yeah. And I mean, it's amazing. Like with Henry, people may not know his name. You may know the handle of Hoop Diaries though. So he does this amazingly creative job of looking at mentors' work, like with Game Changer with Fergus and, Dan Pfaff, you know, is another one, whose work he's been inspired by. You know, Dan works with Stu McMillan and all those great coaches at Altus. And then just riffing on it and putting it into the context of basketball. And he almost does it in like a comic book or graphic novel fashion. He's just an amazing creative talent who happens to coach basketball players in a really responsible and caring way. But yeah, it's just people's life stories and where they bumped into the game of basketball, what it's given to them, maybe some advice of how to help younger coaches or younger players along the way. And then we always end with what does it mean to be basketball? To you to be basketball strong, whether that's a soul thing, whether that's technical thing, whether that's a physical thing, what does it mean to you to be basketball strong?
It's a great question. It's a really good way to be able to allow the person to sort of boil down their relationship to the game into one question. And I'm sure you get a lot of different answers and a lot of interesting ones. We have blown past an hour and a half, Phil. We probably have like 4 more hours we could talk. Oh. But I want to give you a chance before we get out of here just to share, where can people find your books? And then just give them again the name of the podcast, sure, where they can find that. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
No, it's most kind, and I appreciate you letting me. I'm very caffeinated, as anyone knows me during the work. I love a good espresso, so yeah, thank you for being patient with me rambling. But the most recent book is The Leader's Mind with Dr. Jim Aframo, who people may know from The Champion's Mind, his first book. And we've got 2 more coming out in the next 2 years. So check that out. Check out Jim at Gold Medal Mind on Twitter now, ironically, as we've been talking about social media. But yeah, everything he shares is super inspirational. And
yeah, really is a sports psychologist. He's at the very top of his game. So a joy to work with Jim and learn from him. And then, as you mentioned, Unplugged with Dr. Andy Galpin and Brian McKenzie. If there's anyone who's into water sports, check out Waterman 2.0 with Kelly Starrett, which is basically Supple Leopard, but through the lens of surfing, paddleboarding, canoeing, kayaking, that kind of thing. Any water sports people. If you're a sports scientist or a coach or a performance director, or you want to get your kids studying that stuff, check out Game Changer with Fergus Connolly and then all of Fergus's other great books. And then, as you said, the Basketball Strong podcast is just what it sounds like. Search the whole thing, because if you just type Basketball Strong, some weird other stuff comes up. But yeah, I think you'll dig it. Again, start with the Henry Barrera episode and then go where your curiosity draws you. But we just had Carrie Moore, the Harvard women's coach, on. She was amazing. The Byron Scott double episode is really great as well. And yeah, we'd love it if you like it. Just subscribe, as always, so you don't miss any episodes. Give us a like, give us a review, because that, in a competitive marketplace on Spotify and Apple, just clicking like and giving us a few good star reviews, that really does help, as you know, from your great podcast. So yeah, appreciate,
makes a big difference.
Appreciate everyone listening to my waffling and really blessed by this conversation today.
Phil, can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule this afternoon to join us. I know we've been trying to make this happen for a while, so it was good to finally get it done. Great conversation. Really enjoyed every second of it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.